y'all. Thanks for listening to Killer Queens.
Or KQ if you're nasty.
Welcome to the show where two 90s loving country chicks gab about true crime and tell each other to talk to the hand because the face ain't listening. I'm Torella.
And I'm Tori.
And we're sisters who have always loved true crime and decided to turn that obsession into a show with a light take on the topic.
Kind of like diet true crime, it's all the flavor and fewer calories.
Now with our show, you'll get true crime, 90s nostalgia, and a few four-letter words sprinkled in.
Because I always say that Polly Pockets and true crime go together like peas and carrots.
Be sure to check out our case submission form on our website at killerqueenspodcast.com and follow us on social media and YouTube.
Now grab your Surge, your 3D Cool Ranch Doritos, and your kitten surprise, and let's get into the episode.
This episode contains discussion of abduction, kidnapping, rape, strangulation, and murder. And these are cases involving both adults and teenage girls. Listener discretion is advised.
Since the early 1970s, dozens of bodies of murder victims have been found along the Interstate Highway 45 area. While there have been arrests made for some of the murders that have taken place in the area, the vast majority remain unsolved. Some theorize that the area served as a dumping ground for multiple serial killers that were operating in the area, but that has never been proven.
Hey, you guys, welcome to Killer Queens. If you've never been here before, we want to give you just a little information about how the show is set up and what it's meant to accomplish. If you have been here before, welcome back. You can just use that handy skip ahead feature here if you want to.
We want to give a message to friends and family of the victims. We know that there may be someone involved in the case who might listen one day, and we want you to know that our intention is to only bring awareness to this case. And while we do use personal stories in some instances and our own humor in order to tell the story in a way that listeners can relate, we have the utmost respect for victims and their families.
We created Killer Queens to be a place where we can have open discussions about cases just like you would with friends. We are not investigators. We use information that is available to the public, such as documentaries, case files, and media coverage. Using this information, we intend to tell the story of what happened in each case that we cover. Now, will you agree with our interpretations or conclusions of each case? Well, heck no.
Mm-mm. We each approach cases from different perspectives, life experiences, and beliefs that we already have in place. And sometimes these differences are slight, yet they can be wide enough to cause divide and upset some of those listening. We do our best to present the facts as we find them in our research, but we do bring our own perspectives to the case. We understand that you will too. We want you to know that this is a safe space to discuss differences and opinions in a civilized manner. Our style may not be your personal preference, and if that's the case, we know you'll be able to find one of the many other shows out there to tell the story the way you want to hear it. We can be grown-ups about it if you can.
Now, if we are your cup of tea and you want even more KQ, you can join our Patreon and get access to our entire catalog of episodes ad-free and access to bonus episodes too. And I'll give you just a little hint if you're an ad skipper, but you still want the deals that we have from our sponsors each week, you can scroll down to the show notes and see what coupons we have available for you right down there.
But you didn't hear it from us.
That's a pro tip, but I'll deny ever sharing it.
Right. So all that being said, let's get into the story.
All right. So in the last episode, we finished up with a total of four bodies of females found in the Calder Road area, referred to as the Texas Killing Fields. And we haven't talked about suspects or anything yet.
And unfortunately, I'm so sorry, but unfortunately, we have more victims to talk about.
Yeah. Yeah. This is definitely a pretty big case. There's a lot that goes into it. So we had to break it into the two parts here. And
I honestly think that there is probably more than we're even giving you. So,
oh yeah, 100%. Yeah. And even doing two parts, this is kind of a scratching the surface kind of thing. I mean, there's a lot that goes into this case.
If you do want something to watch on it, there is the three-part docuseries on Netflix. It's called The Killing Fields or Texas Killing Fields, excuse me. I'm sure. I don't know if there are any other docuseries similar to that, but
yeah,
there are articles, there are, you know, YouTube videos, there are things that you can access.
All kinds of stuff. Yeah. So welcome back. If you're listening, thanks for listening. And if you're watching on the YouTubes, thanks for watching.
Yes.
We're like still fairly new to the YouTube game. So it's.
But you know what? We're here and we're ready.
We're doing it.
We're doing it.
We're doing it. All right. So over the course of the next several years, there were many attempts to identify Jane and Janet Doe. Authorities tried to create a rendering of what they might have looked like, but there were never any clues or tips to who they might be. And then something happened. So technology advanced. And eventually, investigators were able to use the one thing they did have from both bodies to identify them, which was DNA. Now, as we all know, there are a plethora of companies that will allow you to submit samples of your DNA and map out your family history or family tree. There's Ancestry DNA, 23andMe, MyHeritage, etc. They took DNA profiles from the bodies and submitted them to several family tree DNA databases. And eventually, after years, the FBI was able to identify both Jane and Janet Doe in 2019.
And I will say, if you do watch the 3-part series on Netflix, one of the investigators who was part of this investigation, he really pushed for this and he got some pushback from it. He was like, I really, really think that this could be a great way to identify the Jane and Janet Doe. And it took a while, but he was able, I don't know if he was the first person in the investigative field to have done this, but it was pretty amazing.
Mm-hmm. I mean, we're making a lot of strides with that. Joseph D'Angelo, the East Area Rapist original Night Stalker, finally later dubbed as the Golden State Killer.
Yes.
He was ear-ons for a long time.
Yeah.
He was identified that way. I mean,
it's just amazing.
Yeah.
And, I mean, DNA, it doesn't always have to come from your blood. So
right.
I think that it's amazing that.
Can you imagine, though, if you like were somebody who like killed somebody in the 70s and you were like, got away with
shaking
that shit.
Shaking in your boots.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then your niece is like, oh, hey, I submitted my stuff to 23andMe. It'd be fun to find out my family history. And you're like, damn it, Denise.
Exactly. So. Oh my gosh. I just, side note, you saying, damn it, Denise, reminds me of, I just started rewatching Dodgeball and it's, God damn you, Bernice.
Yeah, Bernice.
Yeah.
I knew what you were going to say right when you said things. Yeah. Yeah. So Jane Doe was actually identified as Audrey Lee Cook. She was born in Memphis in 1955, and at the time of her death, she's estimated to have been 30 years old. She was last heard from in late December of 1985. At the time, she lived in the Houston area and had a history of working at various shops as a mechanic. Her body was discovered on the same day as Laura Miller's. She had a small caliber gunshot wound to her back, which had severed her spinal cord. Her body had additional injuries, including broken ribs. Janet Doe was identified as Donna Prudhomme, born in 1957 in Port Arthur, Texas, and she was last heard from in July of 1991 in Nassau Bay, Texas. Donna had moved around Texas for several years before eventually settling in Nassau Bay. It's reported that she moved frequently because she was trying to escape an abusive relationship, and she chose Nassau Bay because there was more opportunity for employment in the area compared to others. After her body was discovered, though, no cause of death could be determined.
And I will say, based on the Texas Killing Fields docuseries, the police initially thought that these two women were transients. Their words, not mine. It's neither here nor there to us, because it doesn't matter if you are coming, going, if you're a local, if you're whatever. For me, it seemed like they were like, well, they're just transients. And, you know, like.
Right. It's like, okay, well, there are plenty of people who travel around and don't necessarily put down roots in one place or another. And there are various reasons for that, all of which still make them human and worth identifying.
And finding their
They're murderer. Like,
and even if this is a transient person, it's a person who was killed and dumped in your backyard. So what that tells you is there is somebody in your area who is harming people.
Yeah.
And nobody's safe until you figure this out.
Absolutely.
Whatever.
Throughout the 70s, 80s, and 90s, League City residents were basically petrified of what was going on surrounding their town. Understandably so. Young women were going missing at an alarming rate. And at that point, police seemed, I think, at the very best inept. And, you know, that might not be fair to say because we don't really know what was going on in the background. We only know what we have been given and told about. But, you know, all we can comment on is what is available. And from the outside looking in, it just seemed like the police were lost in quite a few of these investigations. Ellen Beeson was 30 years old when she vanished in 1984. Friends and family described her as generous and kind-hearted. She had a jovial nature and that helped her make friends very quickly. She was quite popular among her friend group and her community. She and her friends loved going out bar hopping, which they were doing one evening in 1984. Her friends said that they all gathered at the Texas Moon Bar. And you might remember the Texas Moon from episode 1. So this is the same bar that Heidi Fey worked at.
Mm-hmm.
So while they were there, they said that Ellen had met a quote-unquote handsome man. And the two spent most of the night together and they danced together. They seemed to be having an amazing time. When it came time to leave, though, Ellen told her friends, just go ahead without me. I'm going to get a ride with the handsome man that I'm dancing with. And they decided after leaving the bar that they were going to go to a nearby lake and swim. And then he was going to bring her home after. So Ellen, unfortunately, never made it home that night. Her family was extremely worried from the start and formed search parties to go to various places that Ellen was known to frequent, including the Texas Moon. And the police were notified and they, along with the family, searched all along the lake that Ellen had been swimming at the night before. But unfortunately, they didn't find any signs or clues that led them to any of Ellen's whereabouts or Ellen's whereabouts. Ellen's friends went back to the bar and found the man that Ellen left with that night, and his name is Clyde Hedrick. In particular, one of Ellen's friends, Candy Gifford, kept going back and she kept talking to Clyde. For weeks, she talked to him, and she often brought up the subject of Ellen disappearing. Initially, Clyde told everyone that Ellen had left with a group of people that he didn't know. He said that he saw her get into a truck with these people and she left. Candy kept asking him more and more questions, and the more that she asked about Ellen, the more angry and annoyed he got as the weeks went on.
It's just like she meets him. They seem to be really hitting it off, and so her friends are leaving, and she's like, hey, I'm going to catch a ride with this guy. I'd like to see where this is going, or whatever, which, like, many of us have done that. I have too. You don't think it's dangerous. I mean, you know, they're around other people and, you know, it's like not like you met him in an alley, you know, out back. Yeah. It's like he's at the bar too. We're all hanging out, having fun, like whatever. But then he's like, oh yeah, but after you guys left, she just got in the car. She got in a truck with a bunch of random people and left. So I don't know. Like, No.
And then it's a big red flag too on top of that. That her friend is going back to him to be like, hey, what happened? And he's like, quit asking me about this. Like, he's like so annoyed and frustrated.
Right. Yeah, like even if you didn't have anything to do with it, you seem to have been hitting it off with her too. So it's like, oh my gosh, like, okay, maybe I wasn't ever planning on seeing her again or whatever, but that's awful that she's missing. Like, I can't believe that, you know, like, I don't know. But he's just like,
possibly let me help you look for her or, you know, like
yeah, something like that, maybe even.
So finally, after Candy brought it up again, Clyde snapped and he said, quote, well, then I'll show you where she is. And he drove Candy to a location near a bridge on a dirt road by some railroad tracks. On the side of the road, there was an old sofa that someone had thrown out and then it had some tires stacked on it. Clyde removed the tires, and that's when Candy saw Ellen's remains. It had been 6 months since she had been missing. It took another few months for Candy to go to the police, and some say it was because she was scared of Clyde. He told her that if she told anyone, she would end up in the same exact position that Ellen was in. But eventually she did go to the police, and the area they found Ellen was around 25 miles from the Texas Moon Bar. Ellen's body had been badly decomposed since it was exposed to the Texas elements all that time. When they brought Clyde in, his story was that they were going swimming. While there, Ellen said that she wanted to go skinny dipping. And so he's on the shore, she's in the water, and he looks out and he just sees her floating in the water. So he assumes that she has drowned. He said that when he got her, he put her in the back of his truck and he started driving to the hospital. But on the way, he was like, oh my God, somebody is going to think that I killed her. So he stopped, he puts her body on the couch and he puts her under the tires.
What a leap. Like, something has happened and this person has drowned.
Mm-hmm.
I'm on the way to bring them to the hospital, and all of a sudden, he's like, no, they're going to think I killed her. I can't do that. Why?
Do you know why? I know why. Because it's a fucking lie.
Exactly. Like, tell me you killed her without telling me you killed her.
Exactly. Ellen's remains were taken to the medical examiner's office, where they said that the cause and method of her death couldn't be determined at that time. The only charge that could be brought against Clyde was abuse of the corpse. He was found guilty and given a fine of $2,000 and 1 year in prison. And after his year in jail, he was released and he was free to go. And that was in 1996. Ellen's body was found in Dickinson, Texas, which is about 4 miles from League City. And she went missing in the same time frame as the Calder Road cases. So it only made sense that if Clyde was a suspect in Ellen's case, he could also be involved in the others. The minute that Tim learned about Ellen Beeson's case, he was asking questions about Clyde Hedrick. He learned that the house that he lived in when Laura went missing was only 2 houses down from where Clyde lived at the time. They were so close to each other. I mean, damn near neighbors.
Yeah.
And he asked one of Laura's friends about Clyde, and she said that they would go walking in the area, and when they would do that, they would go way out of the way of Clyde's house because Laura was scared of him.
And Clyde was a creepy SOB.
Yeah.
He was real creepy.
Yeah.
He did a lot of, like, just sexual predator type things.
He seemed to be very quick to anger too.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. He was very, like, abusive very in any relationships that he was in.
Yes.
Yeah. Just all the stuff.
Yes. So let's flash forward. We're going to go to 2011. Clyde Hedrick's ex-wife approached authorities and said that over the years, Hedrick had made several incriminating remarks about Ellen Beeson's death. In 2012, they exhumed Ellen's body. They re-examined her remains. And during this, they ruled that she had suffered several severe skull fractures, which resulted in her death. I'm kind of confused how they couldn't figure that out.
That's what I was thinking. Why did they not? I know that, like, okay, you might not. I mean, it had been 6 months exposed to the elements. But if you can find skull fractures that severe now, why were they not found before?
Well, and we're not talking about advances in technology hindering a cause of death. This is literally looking at bones. So it's just confusing to me.
And a skull fracture is, and the way that they describe the skull fracture, like if you, because in the documentary, you see some of the questioning from with the investigator and Clyde. And this guy, the detective, is like, this isn't she fell down and bumped her head. This is a severe skull fracture. Like, part of her skull missing skull fracture.
Mm-hmm.
And there's no way she could have survived it. Okay, we didn't see that the first time because...
Tell me exactly. And with that statement from his ex-wife and the findings from the second autopsy, they were able to get an arrest warrant and charge Hedrick with Ellen Beeson's murder, and that was in 2014. Hedrick was found guilty of involuntary manslaughter, and he was given the maximum sentence, which was 20 years in prison. When he was in jail, Hedrick made a confession to another inmate that he had raped and killed Laura Miller, and killed Heidi Fye. In Texas, though, jailhouse confessions, they cannot be used to secure a conviction, and the information given has to be corroborated.
Which it should be.
Absolutely. I agree 100%. In October of 2021, Hedrick was released from prison to mandatory supervision. This made me the most angry I've ever been. Not the most angry I've ever been, but it made me very, very angry. So he ended up serving 8 years. And he was released. 20-year sentence.
Mm-hmm.
And he got out in 8.
Mm-hmm.
And it was mandatory, so nobody could appeal it. And he, over the years, he had been up for parole, but they denied him. Mm-hmm. But then 8 years in, yeah, they were like, well, good time or a good behavior, time served, he's good to go.
And he was not unknown to law enforcement when he got arrested. He'd been in and out of jail for other various things. Okay, we're just going to let him go.
Yeah, I mean, according to the Texas Board of Pardons and Paroles website, mandatory supervision is a legislatively mandated release of a prisoner to parole supervision when the combination of actual calendar time and good conduct time equal the sentence. Who's in charge of knowing that?
Yeah.
I don't think that there is an exact scale of how good you have to be. Mm-hmm. Do you know what I mean? Like, I'm confused.
Yeah.
Good conduct time is credited to an offender for participating in work and self-improvement programs.
Such as what?
I know, exactly. So, I mean, at this point, he's free. And this law or loophole has since been changed. In July of 2022, Tim Miller filed a civil suit against Hedrick for the wrongful death of his daughter, Laura. He was awarded $24 million. And so Hedrick has been found civilly liable, but not criminally liable for Laura's death. But I mean, like, what do you guys think the chances are of Tim getting the $25 million?
Exactly.
$25 million from Hedrick. I don't.
Yeah. And you know, he doesn't want the money. He wants the information that would come out in the suit. But yeah.
100%.
Yeah. All right. So now we're going to talk about Robert Abel. Robert Abel was a former NASA engineer who owned land that was right next.
Did you say a former?
Did I? Former. Yeah. I'm channeling South Carolina.
Yes, you went Colonel Sanders.
Yeah. who owned land that was right next to the Calder Road oil field. Man, that is tough for me. He drew suspicion from many people in the Killing Fields cases, partly because of how close he was to Calder Road, but also because the authorities had reached out to the FBI to create a probable profile of their killer or killers. In this profile, they stated that they believed the killer would likely have a tendency for anger problems, sexual violence, cruelty towards animals, and an air of superiority when it came to his intelligence. As it happened, Abel fit many of those. He had ex-wives who reported that he was abusive and made threats against their lives, particularly when they would not perform or meet his sexual demands. It's also said that he was cruel to the horses on his ranch, beating them, sometimes to the point of death, and then leaving their bodies in the fields. He also had a tendency to try to insert himself into the investigation, and we've seen that with other cases. He constantly offered law enforcement his opinions on the case, as well as offering to lend his equipment to search and rescue teams scouring the area. A search warrant was later executed at Abel's property. Authorities found several suspicious items, including human teeth and news clippings about the Texas Killing Fields murders. But nothing conclusively linking Abel to the deaths was found during the search. Repeated interrogations of Abel also did not uncover any new information about the murders. So Tim Miller caught wind of Abel possibly being involved in the disappearances or murders in the area, and he set his sights on him. While the police had essentially moved on from Abel as a suspect at this point, Tim had not. He believed that Abel was guilty, and this was before all of the information came about Clyde Hedrick or anything. So right now, at this point in time, Tim thinks Robert Abel has killed his daughter. Tim regularly parked outside Abel's house and watched him. Tim said he would go and sit there 2 or 3 times a day. He sent threatening letters to Abel and left him voicemails. Abel went to the police to get a court order that forbade Tim from approaching him, but that did not stop Tim. He continued to make threats, going as far as telling Abel he was going to have him kidnapped and then bury him alive in the Nevada desert. All the evidence that connected Abel was circumstantial and was never, he never was charged with anything. The damage had been done, though, in the court of public opinion. His life was ruined because of all the scrutiny and allegations. He ended up selling his property and moving from League City to live with a family member. In 2005, Abel drove a golf cart into the path of an oncoming train and died. Tim Miller said that before Abel died, he'd seen him out in town and approached him. He told Abel that he was sorry for everything. He no longer believed that Abel was involved in Laura's murder. He asked him for his forgiveness, and he says that they both cried and had made their peace. And that's just really sad. Yeah, just the whole thing is sad. I mean, if the things that came out about Robert Abel are true, this is not necessarily, you know, a person that was living an upstanding life, doing some stuff he shouldn't be doing for sure. But it can definitely be life-changing, life-altering, to have your name associated with an investigation.
Oh, 100%.
You know, because like once that gets out there, it's hard to go back. And I can't imagine, as you know, if it was my loved one who had been found murdered and the information I was getting from the police was he looks good for this. I mean, I don't know, you know, I can't imagine how you might just go full force into it. And, you know, and I know that Tim has certainly done some things that he's not proud of, and those things were not right either. I just, you know, it's just the whole thing is just tragic all the way around.
Oh, absolutely. It's just, how do you, you can't put yourself in the position that anybody else in this, unless you've been there, obviously, right? Which if you have, I'm so, so sorry. I'm so sorry. I've never been in that position, so I cannot say with certainty how I would act or what I would do.
Mm-hmm.
It's just, it's heartbreaking to hear how the ripple effect has affected so many people. In this case, but other cases that we have covered. I mean, of course, first and foremost, the victims, but then we've got the family members, the friends, the loved ones. Then, and it's something that I never thought about before doing this podcast,
mm-hmm.
but somebody who has been wrongfully accused or wrongfully suspected, because those two terms are used interchangeably on media, in media. To me, it at the time meant the same thing.
Yeah.
Yeah. So,
yeah. Yeah. Because, you know, many times the view of a lot of people, we thought this growing up, like the police wouldn't suspect them if they hadn't done something wrong, right?
No.
And
absolutely.
And there are actually, I'm not saying this specifically about this, but there are actually like, reasonable explanations for things that look very suspicious at first.
Yeah.
One big one being he hired a lawyer, you know,
mm-hmm.
that yeah. used to be nail in the coffin to me, you know, when I was growing up watching this stuff in high school, whatever, when they would be like, yeah. So when the police tried to talk to them, he had gotten a lawyer. I was like, arrest him. He's guilty. Got a lawyer. Innocent people don't need lawyers.
Absolutely. And knowing what we know now, we preach it all the time. Hire a lawyer.
I'm sorry. If a police officer like smiles at you in the morning and says, how you doing today? I would like a lawyer. I would like a lawyer.
Exactly.
Just don't exactly. even mess with it. Yeah.
Yes. I mean, it's just, I don't know. It just, it makes, I think it makes us both so sad. Like it's, because look at what his life became.
Mm-hmm.
And while I understand you have to look at everybody and you have to, but it also, this case pisses me off with that kind of stuff because they did so little and then they did too much.
Uh-huh.
You yeah. know?
Yeah, they just kind of went after the wrong, I don't know. It's just, they did nothing for so long. And then by the time they really started looking into it,
it's like, well
all the evidence is gone.
The wrong person.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I don't know. I don't know. So next we're going to talk about Laura Smither and Sandra Sapo. Excuse me. Laura Smither was born in June of 1980 in Houston, Texas, and was the daughter of Bob and Gay Smither. Laura was an athletic and enthusiastic young woman. She enjoyed playing soccer. She participated in track and field events. I don't know anything about the track and field portion. Did want to play soccer, did not want to run, though, so that wouldn't have worked for me. But
no.
She was also known for her kind and generous nature. She was always willing to help others in need, and she was a vibrant and talented person. She made friends very easily. On April 3rd, 1997, Laura told her mom that she was going to go for a run near her home in Friendswood, Texas. This is before they sat down for breakfast. She, unfortunately, never returned home. Her family immediately launched a search for her, but there was no sign of her anywhere. The community actually quickly rallied behind the Smithers. They organized search parties. They distributed flyers in an effort to find Laura. But 17 days later, her body was discovered in a retention pond near her home. The investigation into Laura's murder was lengthy and it was complex. Police found evidence of a struggle at the scene of her abduction, but no clear leads. However, one piece of evidence was crucial in solving her case, and this was a video surveillance tape from a nearby store that captured footage of a suspicious vehicle in the area around the time of Laura's disappearance. The vehicle was identified as a white Mazda pickup truck. Sandra Sapo was 19 years old. Did I say it wrong again? Sapo.
I think it's Sapo.
I know it's Sapo, but I keep wanting to say Sapo and I have no idea. So I am so sorry. Sandra Sapo was 19 years old in May of 1997. She made plans to meet a friend at the Houston or at a restaurant in Houston. On the way, she stopped at a gas station in Webster, Texas, which is about a half hour drive to Houston. And while she was at the gas station, she noticed a creepy guy staring at her. She wanted to get away from the man and the gas station, so she jumps in her car and quickly drove away. But while she was doing this, so of course she's really worried about getting away. She wants to get out as quickly as possible. She didn't realize that her tires were slashed. So she's driving and then she stops at a nearby Waffle House. A man pulled in behind her and offered her help and then quickly pulled a knife on her and put it to her throat. The man forced her into his truck, told her to undress as he drove down I-45. And Sandra said the only thing that she could think about was what this guy was going to do to her and how he was going to kill her. And she said she'd rather kill herself by jumping from the truck than whatever he was going to do to her.
Mm.
She opens the door and she jumps out while they're on the interstate. She suffered severe injuries, but she escaped the man. And not only that, she was able to tell authorities several details about the man and his truck. She worked with a sketch artist to get a picture of the man. And when you see it, and then you see the man who was arrested, I mean, it's like they nailed that. Mm-hmm. Everyone involved nailed it. They also tried to use hypnosis to see if Sandra could recall any details, and she did. She actually told them the license plate number. So using that info, they put together a photo lineup. And when she was shown a photo lineup, she picked out a man from the photos. Then in a physical lineup, she immediately picked out the man who had kidnapped her. And this is William Lewis Reese.
So we actually talked about this case a little bit in our third episode ever. I called this episode The Path to a Serial Killer.
I remember this.
We talked about Todd Kohlhepp and we talked about William Lewis Reese.
It's kind of like how I remember it is domestic violence or other crimes. Domestic crimes are gateway crimes to being a killer.
Mm-hmm. And specifically, the other thing is abduction.
Yes.
Abducting somebody. Which
I think it's violent as well.
Well, yeah, it's absolutely violent. And It's just for so long, those offenses have been like, I mean, again, you know, it feels like law enforcement, maybe not law enforcement, but the laws, the way they're written are, but did you die though? Okay, well, you survived that. So, you know, he gets a few years here and there, but
yeah,
you know, this is in his history. Well, it's that's going to escalate. Eventually, somebody who is kidnapping and raping people and then gets caught for it is not going to leave a witness. There's not going to.
Right. They don't quit doing it. They get better at doing it.
They don't like grow out of it or whatever. William Lewis Reese was born in July of 1959 in Oklahoma. He was one of 13 children. He grew up poor and was forced to drop out of school in the ninth grade and took a job as a farm laborer. He married his first wife in 1979 after she became pregnant and shortly after enlisted in the Oklahoma National Guard. A year into their marriage, his wife left him, but Reese convinced her to remarry him after some time apart. They had a second child quickly. Throughout their marriages, she said that Reese would drink heavily. He was physically abusive. In 1982, she went to the police after he severely beat her and threatened to kill her with a knife and shotgun. So she divorced him again. Reese then married a second wife who divorced him a few months into their marriage. In April of 1986, Reese kidnapped and raped a 19-year-old woman. She was the daughter of a sheriff's deputy. She was driving to the gym when her car stalled. Reese pulled up behind her in his truck. He was a truck driver at the time. He lured her into his truck by telling her he would take her to a payphone. He tied her up and raped her. Then he drove to a nearby hotel and rented a room. Once inside, she said she needed to use the bathroom, and when he allowed her to go into the bathroom, she escaped and called police. Reese was charged and arrested, but released on bail.
Why?
I am the blinking guy meme.
Mm-hmm.
What?
Yes. Released on bail.
Yeah.
Perfect.
He kidnapped her and raped her and then brought her to a hotel room to continue to do so. She was not free to leave. Like, a month after his release, while he was awaiting trial, he sexually assaulted another woman and was arrested again. He was put on trial for both rapes, found guilty, and sentenced to 25 years in prison. His attorneys appealed the conviction to a criminal court, which granted a review of his case. The results indicated that there were procedural errors in Reese's criminal case, causing his sentence to be reduced and leading to his parole in October of 1996. After his release, he moved to his mother's home, and in early 1997, regained his driver's license and moved to, wait for it, Houston, Texas.
Okay. Yep.
After Sandra identified Reese as her abductor, he was arrested and eventually faced trial and was found guilty of kidnapping. This time, he was sentenced to 60 years in prison.
Finally.
Let's do that the first time. I feel very strongly that I'm probably never going to believe that kidnapping like this, like abduction, taking
rape
somebody
and
against their will.
Let's not even add the rape to it because he's done this on multiple occasions.
Mm-hmm. That is not something that needs to have a severe sentence associated with it. This couple years here and there for that. Because what's going to happen next? You are going to kill the person you abduct. You just will. I just don't, like, we've seen it too many times. So many cases that we cover have this in their history.
Well, and a lot of the cases, or the ones, some of the ones that we have just talked about with him, it wasn't that he was like, free to go. They escaped.
Exactly. Yeah. Right. It just... Oh my gosh.
Mm.
While they were investigating and throughout his trial and conviction, police began to suspect that he might be involved in other disappearances in the area. It would take some time, but eventually their suspicions were confirmed.
I'm actually shocked that they were like, maybe he did something else, because that's not like police in this area.
I know, right? In the early 2000s, a court order was given to compel Reese for his DNA, which was entered into CODIS. In 2015, a hit was returned to the murder of 19-year-old Tiffany Johnson in Bethany, Oklahoma. Her car was found abandoned in a car wash. The owner told police that Reese frequented the car wash often, and Johnson's body was found later off a dirt road off the interstate. She had been raped, beaten, and strangled. Reese was charged with her murder in September of 2015. In early 2016, he started to cooperate with authorities to try to get a deal of some type. He confessed to 3 murders in Houston in the summer of 1997. He confessed to the murders of Laura Smither, Kelly Cox, and Jessica Kane, in addition to Tiffany Johnston. He told prosecutors that he would admit fully in court to avoid the death penalty and serve his sentence in Oklahoma. They refused the deal and used a map that Reese had provided earlier to excavate the burial sites of Kelly Cox and Jessica Kane. According to Reese, in April of 1997, he was driving and accidentally hit Laura Smither with his car on a rainy day. He may have hit her, but he did not do it accidentally. He saw her running and he hit her.
Yeah.
Yeah. He said that he then took her body and left it in the pond. Later, he admitted that he had actually abducted and strangled her to death. And they were like,
there it is.
Oh, wow, I didn't know that. Yeah.
Yeah.
Like, whatever. Then he said that on July 15th, 1997, he was driving from Oklahoma to Houston when he stopped in Denton, Texas to pick up some whiskey for the drive, as one does.
Well, you're going to want, what do they call them? Roadies.
Yeah, because you don't want to like wait till you get to Texas to drink. Why not drink on the way? It's a long drive.
That's what I always say.
Yeah.
Well.
While at a gas station, he got into a physical altercation with 20-year-old Kelly Cox and strangled her. She was found buried in the woods. On July 26th, 1997, Reese said he stopped at the Sunshine Car Wash to clean his truck and horse trailer and accidentally sprayed Tiffany Johnston. When she confronted him, he grabbed her and drug her into his trailer. He raped her at gunpoint. He then grabbed a horseshoe and hit her on the head with it. He then strangled her and drug her body to the nearby woods and left her there, and it was discovered the next day. Tiffany Johnston's mother was actually one of Reese's mom's friends. He actually knew Tiffany before the attack. Some theorized that he'd been stalking her, waiting for a chance to attack her. Like, is this a car wash where there was just, like, literally nobody else around? How do you get away with something like that at a car wash?
Well, I mean, I have absolutely no idea. The fact that he knew her before and did this anyway is disgusting. And I am just about sick, which I cannot, I don't think that I could be a police officer, detective, investigator, whatever. Anyway, because I'm just simply not smart enough, but also I don't have the patience for all of these fucking lies that they tell, where mm-hmm. they're like, here's what happened. I accidentally hit her. I didn't see her, and I hit her. And you have to be like, I understand that. That makes sense. I get it. When you know full well that they, that did not happen.
Yeah.
Like, exactly. He accidentally sprayed Tiffany. Are you serious? That's yeah. what.
Yeah. I would be like, oh, right.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, go on. Excuse me.
Exactly.
Like, yeah. No. 17-year-old Jessica Kane was reported missing on August 17th, 1997. She was last seen alive after leaving a Bennigan's restaurant. Her car was abandoned on an interstate highway later that day. Reese claimed he had approached her outside the restaurant, but she rejected him, which angered him. He tailed her vehicle until she was forced to stop and confront him.
That checks out. That tracks to mm-hmm. me.
And then he says that he beat and strangled her. What was it in the, when we covered the missing and murdered Indigenous women case, we watched the, I'm forgetting the name of the docuseries.
Yeah, no, it was called Murder in Longhorn, Bighorn. Murder in Bighorn.
And the guy said, there is nothing more dangerous than an insecure man.
Mm-hmm.
And I was just like, slow clap. Like,
yes.
Because how many times have we heard, well, I approached this woman and she rejected me and therefore she had to die.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely.
Okay, here's an idea. Maybe it's too much. Why don't you like be worth not rejecting.
Or
bring something to the table.
Another, right, absolutely. There is a third option there. So what we've got so far is be worthy. I guess you can say an option for some people is murder, violent crimes, whatever. There's also a third option there. And that's, okay, I'm not your cup of tea. I'm going to go find someone who is.
Yeah.
That's fine.
You just, you miss 100% of the shots you don't take. I will move on.
Oh, God. Like, just because you want to get your rocks off or you find someone attractive does not mean that they have to find you attractive. I don't know if anybody knew that, and I don't know who needs to hear it right now, but that's the case.
Right. It's just like, how many women watching this or listening to this have ever been approached by somebody at a bar, at a gas station, at a whatever, and you were not interested? You know? And like, any of those times could have been dangerous.
Mm-hmm.
For the simple fact that as a woman, we had the audacity to say no to somebody because somebody's ego was bruised.
Or at the very least, act uninterested.
Yeah. Yeah. Like, I don't know. Just sometimes I think about that kind of stuff. Like, I was talking to one of my friends about a time that we all went out to the Coyote Ugly Bar in Nashville.
Oh, yeah.
And I don't know why, but it just like popped in my head that, you know, that we had gone there or whatever. And, you know, we were getting hit on. All of us were that night. You know, guys, you know, walk by and say something and you're like, whatever. And she and I got to talking about it, and it was just like, you know, there was a long period of time where I wouldn't wear a dress or a skirt out anymore because men would literally view that as an invitation to stick their hand up my skirt. I'm mm-hmm. like, and like, was it a mini skirt? Yeah.
Yeah, but you're allowed to wear that.
Exactly. Like, so why is that an invitation for you? And why is it that, you know, we were there to have fun with our girlfriends, you know, like we're hanging out, we're having a good time. We want to hang out with each other, which is our right to do. And it's like, you will always have guys coming up and trying to make a pass at you. And then she reminded us of the time that we went to visit her in Florida and we went to a bar with her.
I remember this. Yeah.
And that some guys were trying to talk to us. And she said, like, hey, not interested, whatever. They got so mad and were like making fun of us, calling us derogatory names, saying that we obviously had to have been lesbians because we weren't interested in them. And, you know, just like, but getting really hateful. Like she was like, they were saying some of the most hateful stuff I have ever had said to me for the simple fact that we were not interested in them.
Was this when I was there as well? Okay. Yeah, mm-hmm. I was like, because maybe another situation happened when I wasn't there, but I remember.
Yep. Yeah.
Yeah.
So, and it's just like, you know, sometimes you just look back, like sometimes I'll just think about that kind of stuff. And I'm just like, I never felt like I was in danger, but we absolutely could have been, because you never know which man you're going to come across who believes that his ego is worth more than your life.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I just, it's really disgusting.
You know what? I wouldn't mind seeing a sticker that says there's nothing more dangerous than an insecure man. I wouldn't mind seeing it. I wouldn't mind putting it on shit.
Maybe we should. Maybe that's a merch
idea. Maybe we should.
I mean, because it really is true. You don't see that with women quite so much. And I saw a comedian say something on Facebook Reels, because I'm elderly, who was kind of making the joke about, you know.
It was on Vine.
Oh.
That's not even a thing anymore.
It's not a thing anymore, no. I couldn't figure out what I was supposed to do with it when it was a thing. So,
oh, no, yeah. But maybe MySpace. Maybe it was on MySpace.
And she was talking about how, you know, people say, a lot of people will use the whole, well, you shouldn't wear short skirts, or you shouldn't wear low cut shirts because, you know, men have urges and like, what are they supposed to do? And she was like, it's interesting though. I don't feel like lesbians have a problem. You don't see that, do you? you so never hear it's the man. Exactly. Like you never hear, well, you can't wear low cut shirts around lesbians because you know they can't help themselves. It's just men.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe the problem is the men. Do we hate all men? No.
No.
But we've been in that situation before. I guarantee any woman listening to this or watching this has been in that situation at least once before. Hey, you guys. It's us again.
Yay, it's us.
We threw you for a loop on this one. So we know that a lot of you have been asking, like, WTF, where are episodes 1 through 44? And guess what? Now you can have them.
So let's just remember, though, we need you to take a little caution here. We didn't know exactly what we were doing back then. And we started this podcast as just a fun thing to do as sisters. We had no idea that it would grow into this super awesome club with you guys. So what we're saying is the audio wasn't super amazing, but the content is 100% us. Just being us and talking about some true crime with 90s flair.
Okay, so here are the details. You'll be able to access our what we're calling OG episodes in your favorite podcast app through a private and custom RSS feed link. So to grab that, head over to killerqueens.link/OG and snag episodes 1 through 44 today. That's killerqueens.link/OG.
Well, and listen, I talked about it on the mixtape that we just covered, but recently a friend and I were out. We came in contact with two men. All we did, I smirked at them, kind of like, okay. I didn't give them a full smile. She did. She said hello. And it wasn't necessarily threatening or anything, but it was a lot of catcalling and like kissing at us. And I was like, we have to leave right now. Like that kind of stuff at the very least makes you uncomfortable. I don't think that in any way or any opportunity that anybody has ever presented where that has happened, I don't think that ever works for them. Mm. Why keep doing it? Like all you're doing is making people uncomfortable.
Yeah.
So I have the right to be here the same as you do.
Mm-hmm.
So quit making me feel uncomfortable.
Yeah, exactly. It's just sick.
We have been out. I'm not trying to be like it's all women and not men. Or wait, all men and not women. Excuse me. We have been out where there was a woman who did take advantage of a man who I was out with, a friend of ours, but he was my date that night. And he was like, we have to leave right now. Mm-hmm. Like, I know that yes, it happens.
It absolutely does happen.
Every and all gender and every and all gender are the perpetrators of that. But
yeah, for sure. Yeah. Just our experience is this mm-hmm. way. Yeah. So William Reese said none of the attacks and murders were sexually motivated.
Bold move, Cotton. Let's see if it pays off.
Did he say that with a straight face? Like, when my husband says something that I think is untrue, or you, I say, Jesus can hear you right now.
True.
And so to Bill Reese, I say the same thing. Really, are you serious? Because how many people did you rape?
Mm-hmm.
But none of them were sexually motivated.
No.
When he was questioned about any additional disappearances in the area, he denied any and all involvement. In May of 2021, his trial had been postponed due to COVID. Reese was found guilty in Oklahoma for Johnston's death. In August of 2021, he was given a death sentence by Oklahoma County District Court. He was then extradited to Texas to face trial in March of 2022. He pled guilty to all charges and was given life imprisonment in June of 2022.
I can only surmise, and I could be wrong, but my assumption is that when he went to Texas, they were like, look, you either plead guilty or you go to trial and face the death penalty.
Yeah, we'll send your ass back to Oklahoma.
Yeah.
Yeah. For sure. So, you know, he came up because he obviously was a serial killer. I think he very well could have more victims that he's just not copping to.
Sure. I hate the term copping. I don't know why.
Oh, okay.
I really don't like it.
Okay.
I'm just letting you know. Just
no, by all means,
I'm
so sorry.
I also don't like when people say, oh, it's a vibe. I just don't like that.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. That's tough for me too. But I don't know. I mean, we don't know about Clyde Hedrick. Like right now, we still don't know. We still don't know. Tim Miller still does not know who killed his daughter. Heidi Fye's dad died trying to find out who killed his daughter.
Her mom too.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. That's right. I mean, it's... I hope that their loved ones can get some answers in this lifetime.
But I think that, I mean, Tim Miller was 100% and is 100% right. They did not do enough to preserve enough evidence because, God willing, they could have found them tied up and been able to save. But I think best case scenario, unfortunately, is they could have found some really, really amazing evidence, and they did neither. So,
right. Yeah. Because had they searched when Tim Miller asked them to,
we would be in a completely different situation right now.
Yeah. We could have found some evidence. And, you know, now we could take that sample from Clyde and possibly match it.
Or,
but him living in the same neighborhood and being such a sexual predator and a murderer.
What are the odds, man? What are the fucking odds? Also, maybe just doing a little investigating.
Yeah. Just a little.
Heidi's dad, there are tapes and tapes and tapes and tapes of him recording himself after all of his investigations. He went everywhere. He talked to everyone. He wrote down everything. He recorded everything. The police didn't do half, a fraction of that.
No. Nope. And Tim Miller has now devoted his life to helping other people in his situation.
And you know what? I mean, I don't think that you meant anything. I just want to clear up, like, I don't think that any victim's family is any worse off or any better off than any of the others, but it's just all so sad. Like, look at, I mean, thank God in heaven, Tim Miller has turned his life around in the sense that he did not kill himself, because look at how much better off the world is that he is still here helping so many countless families, because he said, we don't charge anybody. It's all free. We're there.
Yep.
Heidi Fye's parents, they look at what they did, but they had to go to their grave not knowing. Like, it's just not fair.
It's not fair. It's not. So that's the Texas killing fields, guys.
It really, really is. And I just, again, want to reiterate the fact that if you didn't catch it the first time, the first episode, we have a YouTube channel.
Yeah.
It's Killer Queens Podcast. We're on YouTube. Mm-hmm. So you can be watching this. You can be watching Torella's mediocre face and my beautiful face on YouTube.
Well.
Just kidding. But we're there, and we've got all of the previous main feed episodes. They're all there too. So you can go back and rewatch them if you want to.
Beginning at a certain period, but yes.
Oh, that's what I meant. Yes, I'm so sorry. See, misinformation. Here I go.
Yeah.
But we're excited. We want you guys to check out and to take advantage of the YouTube that we have.
Yeah, for sure. And we're going to start putting some other kind of content out here too at some point. So keep an eye out for that.
It's very exciting. But thank you guys so much for listening. Thank you for watching, if you're watching. We hope we catch you on the next episode. And of course, if any cases that we ever cover, if they are unsolved, and if you know anybody, know anything, let someone know.
Yes.
So we got to ask.
Someone know.
But thank you so much. We love you. Bye.
Bye. We'd love to hear your thoughts on this case. Connect with us on Instagram or Facebook to continue the conversation.
Thanks for listening, and we will meet you back here next week.
Bye.
The theme song for the show is created and composed by Stephen Toby. You can find more of Stephen's work on SoundCloud.
Our logo was created by Sloan Williams of Sophisticated Crayon. You can find more of her work on Etsy. Visit us at killerqueenspodcast.com for merch and other info about the show.